Greetings. At the end of February, I was up at CPAC in the Washington Beltway on behalf of the Civitas Institute. I interviewed policy experts and leading figures in the conservative movement for Civitalk. Coming up next, we will air a special CPAC interview from the event. Stay tuned and enjoy.
From the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Ray Nothstein, up here at CPAC, we're talking with Nikki Neely of Speech First. She is one of the top free speech advocates on college campuses in all of the country. And this is a big cultural problem today where speech is being attacked. It's being weaponized against students. Students are being punished for their beliefs, for their conscience. And it's a crisis, really, in this nation. And one of the problems, I think, is that there's a lot of students that are just unaware of how much of a crisis is on campus. And sometimes students can be isolated if they come across this or they feel like their rights have been trampled. They may not know where to turn. Nikki's going to help us out in understanding some of these issues. Nikki, what's the biggest problem when you look at it just from a 10,000-foot level of what is happening on college campuses? Why is this happening? I think it's probably the fundamental question that has to be answered.
Sure. I mean, I think being a student on campus today is like facing death by a thousand cuts. There are so many different ways that universities infringe upon students' rights that, I mean, people have kind of gotten used to it and they think that's how it is. And that's not how it is and that's not how it should be. Universities use things like overbroad speech codes or they create free speech zones. I mean, really, literally delineating out with paint or chalk an area where free speech can take place. I mean, I'm so sorry, but like I grew up in America and I thought that America was a free speech zone. But, you know, I mean, there are campuses like Texas Tech a couple years ago actually had a free speech gazebo, which sounds beautiful, but is also terrifying. There are policies like charging security fees for when outside speakers are brought in. There are student groups that aren't recognized and then don't have access to student funds. And so, you know, they're kind of persecuted that way. There are policies like bias response teams where students can anonymously report each other. And so students just every day face a situation where language or ideas, speech that they might want to express, things they want to talk about, can be deemed, can be called hateful, bigoted, bigoted, and bigoted and biased. And they might face disciplinary action for that. So out of an abundance of caution, if you're in a position where anything you say can get you in trouble at any time, students just don't speak, and they self-censor. In my mind, that self-censorship, that chilling, is the greatest threat to free speech. I mean, free speech zones are terrible and speaker fees are terrible, but if our students start to learn that they need to self-censor and they need to not express opinions, be it political, be it religious, because they're getting in trouble for it, I think that's a downfall of our civilization. We can't survive that way. So
one of the things, there's so many examples of violations of free speech on campuses, and one of the things, you know, I saw recently was pro-life display was knocked down, trampled, these, and administrators don't really do anything, especially when they have these free speech codes or they violate free speech. It amazes me, even with a big university may have a general counsel's office with 5, 10, maybe 15 lawyers on campus. How is this allowed? How is this culture allowed to thrive in college campuses? How is it almost encouraged when you have very educated individuals, you have a community of academia, achievement, where professors are very, very interested in expressing themselves and having their academic freedom? How is this allowed to thrive on college campuses when you have very smart administrators at a lot of colleges?
No, it's a good question. And I mean, I think you're right. There's a two-tier justice system. I talked to a student last summer at a university who he had some people made some hateful posters about him, and he went and complained to the school's bias response team about it. And they told him, if you decide to pursue this complaint, you're a straight white male. The system is not for you. You're going to face more problems than you want. And, I mean, that's preposterous. You know, these are supposed to be colorblind. These are supposed to be, you know, if you're needy, if you're being persecuted, then it should be for you too. And, you know, I think you can look statistically at where some of these administrators are coming from. There's been a lot of reports done by Heterodox Academy, by American Enterprise Institute, by Campus Reform about the political leanings of a lot of administrators, of faculty, and it is overwhelmingly left, and it has been creeping ever far left since, I mean, like the 50s. And so that's a problem, where you're taking some people's sets of concerns more seriously than you are taking others. That's why I'm a limited government, small L libertarian, because I think that giving any bureaucracy a huge amount of discretionary power, no matter what their political leanings are, is problematic. These administrators shouldn't have that kind of discretionary power to say who deserves more justice than others. I mean, that's why we should have very clear rules, and we should enforce them stringently.
I'm up here with Nikki Neely at CPAC. We're talking about free speech on college campuses. And one of the things that I think that is discouraging may be this culture where speech doesn't seem to be as appreciated. This notion of freedom of speech and our inherent rights is not as appreciated as it was in previous generations. I mean, this whole idea, and part of this I think maybe come from secularism to some degree, but this idea of inherent rights may not be properly understood in our culture and society. People look to government first a lot of times, and they don't look to this broader notion that was extrapolated, explained to us in our Bill of Rights. So how do we fundamentally change the culture and maybe just allow students or young people in general, I mean, it can include old people too, but how do we promote free speech as a right, as an inherent right that can't be abridged not only by our government but by public institutions out there?
I'm very concerned with civics education. I think if you have college students who have never really properly understood the First Amendment, who they get to campus when they're 18, and the first time they hear or really understand the First Amendment is when they're told, this is why Richard Spencer can come to your campus, of course you're going to hate the First Amendment. And so I think, you know, we have to start teaching people a lot more, a lot earlier about what this is, why this is important, why this makes America exceptional. But also, I mean, the First Amendment and free speech is a beautiful thing, and I think that side of the story is not told often enough. Free speech is one of the ways that disenfranchised minorities throughout time have been able to make their case. It's how abolitionists were able to convince people that slavery was wrong. It was how suffragists were able to get the vote for women. And, I mean, you think about some of the free speech cases, even just over the past 50-100 years. Martin Luther King wrote letters from a Birmingham jail, from jail, because he had violated a gag order. New York Times v. Sullivan was litigated because politicians in the South didn't want the New York Times writing about Jim Crow. That's so deeply important. This is something that is colorblind, that is, you know, that has helped people make the case for rights for all kinds. So this is not a left issue. This is not a right issue. This is an America issue. And so I think it's, you know, we have to tell the full story, and we have to start telling a lot earlier.
We've had some politicians, including President Obama, that have got up and talked about the importance of free speech on campus and, you know, having space to disagree with people. What can happen more just from a policy perspective? I know our lieutenant governor in North Carolina pushed a bill to expand freedom of expression on campus. But don't you think, too, that, you know, as I think about this from a broader notion, that if you have to introduce legislation to protect the First Amendment, what does that mean as in terms of our culture? Because every time I see someone introducing a bill to protect an inherent right, I feel like we've already lost the battle to some degree. Can you speak to that at all?
No, you're right. I mean, while I'm glad to see state legislatures stepping up and reaffirming the First Amendment, I think it's the First Amendment. It's right there. It's number one. You shouldn't have to do this at all. My husband used to work at the Institute for Justice, and he was on the Kelo trial team. And in the wake of Kelo being wrongly decided, a lot of states stepped in and they reaffirmed this right that was there to start with. So it's frustrating. It's the kind of thing where, you know, we need students to be brave. We need students to first know their rights and then say, and then recognize when they're being violated to do something about it. And we need people to be proud of speaking out. And I mean, like, look, it's a fundamental it's human nature to not, you know, to want to shut down something that you disagree with. And so you sort of have to appeal to the better angels of your nature. Even if somebody is saying something you disagree with, even if somebody is saying something you hate, you know, they have to have the space to say it, because if you would want that same courtesy, right? I mean, it's the First Amendment is not there to protect the happy middle that we all agree on. Like, puppies are good, ice cream is good, right? It's there to protect the outlandish and the outside, and the you know, the edge of the envelope, because that's where policy is made. That's where interesting discussions are made. And to deny people not only the opportunity to have those conversations, but also to deny others the opportunity to listen to those conversations and make up their own mind, I think is really fundamentally disrespectful. And so it's something that everyone has to be vigilant about, because it's in everyone's best interest.
A final question for Nikki here at CPAC. If a student feels like their rights have been violated or the administration has come down on them in an unconstitutional way, what can they do to reach? They may not have a conservative network of support on their campus, or they may not know anybody who they can reach out to. What's something they can do to either reach out to somebody or seek help on an issue like this, especially if they're feeling alienated?
Sure. It's definitely very lonely. So I would encourage people to reach out to me, reach out to Speech First. We're at speechfirst.org. But also to, you know, if it's something that I can't help with, there are lots of organizations out there that want to help, be it Alliance Defending Freedom, be it the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, be it the, you know, pro bono attorneys that might want to help with people. Oftentimes, student problems can be solved just by sending a letter to an administration from a lawyer. Schools don't like that. Sometimes it takes a lawsuit. Sometimes it takes going to the press. Universities hate public pressure. So there's lots of different ways to skin a cat and to help students achieve their goal. My organization, Speech First, is a membership organization. So we're structured in a way that our lawsuits are filed in a way that protects students' anonymity. Other students are okay with their name being in a lawsuit. And so it's, you know, we can achieve the right ends for a student at a school in a way that they're comfortable with. So if it's not through me, it'll be through someone we know. But definitely, you know, don't be afraid to reach out, you know, even to Civitas, who can get in touch with people that you need.
That's Nikki Neely up here at CPAC. We appreciate your time, and thank you for being here today. Is there any last words that you would like our listeners to know about, just on an important topic like speech and how we view rights, how we view just sort of this looking to government first? I think that's one of the big problems we face today, is we often – too often look to government to solve problems, especially our federal government. Calvin Coolidge had a great notion about when you talk about government, if you mean the federal government, in many ways, like I mentioned before, you've already lost the battle when you start categorizing the government that way and looking to the top tier of the federal government. What are some important takeaways from being up here at CPAC, especially on this issue? What are some important things I think listeners need to know about speech and just rights in general?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, what's happening on campus isn't staying on campus. Some of these behaviors that students are learning, go to the bias response team and report on your fellow classmates rather than having a conversation with someone. You know, if I hear you saying something mean, I should go up, you know, it's incumbent on me as a citizen, as an adult, to say, hey, man, don't talk to her that way. It's, you know, to teach someone to encourage that behavior of going and telling the grown-ups, of going and telling the government, it's really dangerous, and I think it really undermines community. You know, it starts small, as you said, but these behaviors end up getting ingrained in people and getting carried over into the broader world, into society, into the workforce. And so it really is time to draw a line in the sand and say, you know what, we deserve better.
We're here with potential candidate Lee Murphy, who is considering running for Congress of Delaware at large. There's one seat there. And we're also here with Sherry Gerald, and we're going to talk about the federal debt deficit and spending. This is a crisis that has been going on for a long time. I'm near 40 years old, and I can remember in the 1980s, Reagan, other politicians talking about the debt, and nothing has been done, because back then it had passed $1 trillion. We're now $22 trillion in debt. So I'm going to ask Mr. Murphy, how can this problem be solved? Because we've been talking about it for decades and decades, and nothing has been done. It's only gotten worse and worse.
Ray, it's a pleasure to be with you. And talking about the debt, and it's $22 million, as you mentioned, right now. And under Reagan, it was $1 trillion. And I feel that the Congress of the United States in each administration since President Reagan, they haven't addressed the debt. It's easy to spend money when you're in Washington, one project after another, after another, after another. $22 million in debt is not sustainable. It's if we don't do something about it now, we have to cut spending. Congress really needs to take a hard look at all the programs, eliminate those programs that are wasteful. I know we talk about this over and over and over again, but at $22 trillion, it's really time to rein it in. It's not going to happen overnight. It may take a generation to bring it down. But on the other hand, President Trump, with his tax cuts, the tax revenue is going to increase into the Treasury of the United States. So with these tax cuts, and we need more tax cuts in the future, increased revenue through tax revenue is also going to bring that debt down. So the debt is important, but I think the main concern is tax cuts, more tax cuts, bring that money into the United States Treasury, bring that deficit down. Congress has to be vigilant and bring their spending down. And we just cannot spend money we do not have. We're mortgaging the future. I don't want my grandkids to be in debt. I don't want them to have a $30 trillion deficit.
Let me ask you about this, because everybody is mad at Congress. Congress has record a low approval rating several times. You know, every time we kind of poll it, it seems like it's a record low. But 92% of congressmen and women get reelected. So where's the disconnect with a lot of voters out there on this issue of debt? Because they complain about spending, but nothing gets done, and they keep reelecting the same people to Congress.
Well, again, you know, as long as their congressperson brings that little piece of pie back to their district and they build their roads and take care of everything else that needs to be taken care of, those people are happy in that particular district. The deficit to them is a far-off thing in Washington, D.C., and it doesn't concern their state or their community. So as long as their congressman makes them happy every 2 years, you know, the deficit is something that doesn't really affect them. And when it comes to time to vote, run again, boom, they're back in there, and we still have the same problems over and over again.
I have a question for Cheryl. One of the things that we hear about is, you know, there's going to be consequences to the debt. We got record debt in this country, but we don't necessarily see it. We see kind of the culture is also struggling with their finances, whether it be record student loan debt, credit card debt amongst Americans. What is the ramifications of the amount of debt that we're racking up to, just for our economy and sort of future ability to spend and invest? I mean, what could happen as a result of $22 plus trillion in debt?
Well, I want to distinguish household debt, like student loans and credit cards, from government debt, because the government can raise taxes to pay it off. Individuals, they can literally go bankrupt. So it's a much more serious, immediate problem for individuals because they have a limited budget. The government, they're not spending their own money. That's one of the reasons that they rack up these bills like they do. So what could happen? Theoretically, what could happen is, let's say the Fed continues to raise interest rates or we end up with inflation, the interest cost on the existing debt could take out a larger chunk of the revenue base that we have. So that could be a serious issue where you don't have enough money to support the social welfare programs and defense, et cetera. But I want to clarify one thing. The debt is basically accumulation of deficits, and deficits are government spending this year greater than tax revenues this year. So the solution is not, for example, a balanced budget, because all that would do without cutting spending or making spending more intelligent, as Lee was saying, we would just raise taxes to balance the budget. So that doesn't discipline anybody. But what President Trump has been doing better than in the past is that the spending itself is enabling the private economy to become more productive. So we're enhancing the growth base that will, at least in part, finally grow us out of debt. Another thing that's concerning is that when you mentioned $22 trillion in debt, that's just the debt that's easy to measure. That's top-line debt. We have probably five times that amount in unfunded liabilities. So the problem is actually more significant. You would be amazed, however, how very, very quickly we could, with a robust economy, with more people working and generating income and tax revenues than are getting welfare payments, how quickly we can turn this around. So debt is not inherently bad. It is a complement to the U.S. economy and the productivity of the average U.S. citizen that foreign countries and individuals want to hold our debt because they know, because of the productivity of the U.S. American worker, that is why we're able to go into debt, because they know they're going to get their money back. It's not the government paying that money back. It's private industry profits paying it back. We couldn't even borrow if not for the American worker.
One final question for you. I think this is an important question, and you can totally, Lee, jump in on this. Let me ask you, what is the political threat with all this debt? Because I could see a problem where maybe we decide, because the interest on the national debt is about to surpass defense spending. I think maybe this year or early next year, it's going to surpass defense, all of our defense spending in the budget alone. So how's that going to affect maybe future retirees in terms of, you know, will they go after 401ks more? Will they go after Roth IRAs? Will they have to add a payroll part of the tax that talks about debt, you know, in terms of, you know, maybe you'll have a little line on your payroll tax that says interest for the national debt because of all this spending. I mean, there has to be some kind of a reckoning politically where future people suffer, and what might that look like? I think that's really the important question that a lot of people are thinking is, what will this look like in the future in terms of how much more taxes I'm going to pay? How much more of my retirement could be confiscated through taxation because of this?
Well, you'd only need to raise your taxes if the revenue of the economy wasn't going up, if people weren't earning a return on their stock investments, if the value of their property wasn't going up. So you're not going to need to raise taxes as long as you have a robust economy that's supported by federal policy. We have a business-friendly president who's cutting wasteful regulations and cutting taxes and allowing people to keep more of their own money. It isn't necessarily true that as long as you have a robust economy, that you're going to end up with needing to raise taxes to pay off interest. You just float more debt to pay that off as long as the economy is supported by federal policies and we allow private industry to do what they do best and employ people.
I'd like to rein in the debt and have the prosperity where you would have little debt and a really robust economy like we have now. That would be the ideal scenario for this country.